This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As funerals were underway for some of the 40 Iraqis killed yesterday, suicide bombers struck in the capital today, killing 15 more. In both cases, the targets were Iraqi police. Despite unprecedented sweeps by American and Iraqi forces through dangerous areas of the capital, its suburbs, and through Anbar province to the west in recent weeks, the rate and ferocity of attacks appear undiminished. Yesterday, the New York Times quoted an unnamed senior Army intelligence officer in Iraq. "We are killing or capturing a lot of insurgents," he said, "but they are being replaced quicker than we can interdict their operations. There is always one more insurgent ready to step up and take charge." With a deadline approaching for completion of a draft constitution, the news was not all grim. Sunnis today agreed to rejoin the talks. But as negotiators struggle with difficult issues of federalism, religion, women's rights, and more, security, or the lack of security, undermines efforts to develop Iraq's economy, rebuild vital infrastructure, and establish democratic institutions. Over the next couple of days, we'll focus on a number of issues: security and daily life today, the constitutional process tomorrow. Later in the program, TV producer Stephen Bochco joins us to talk about his new show about American troops in Iraq, over there. But first, if you have questions about the progress of the war, about the drain on U.S. forces, or the training of Iraqi police and military units, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Retired Army General Barry McCaffrey toured Iraq last month, and he testified last week before the Senate Armed Forces Committee. General McCaffrey joins us now by phone from his office in Arlington, Virginia. Thanks very much for being with us on the program.
Good to be with you, Neil.
There are a number of specifics in your testimony I want to ask you about, but overall, you said after six difficult months, you see a turning point that ought to allow significant reductions in U.S. troops by this time next year. Why?
Well, I think some of the observations I had are probably counterintuitive, given the level of violence, which clearly is accelerating. You know, there's 60, 70 attacks per day on coalition forces, and the jihadist element, foreign fighters, are clearly targeting now both innocent Iraqi civilians as well as the Iraqi security forces, the most vulnerable targets of all. On the other side of the equation, it seems very plausible to me that in the coming months we'll see increasingly Sunni Muslim political participation, hopefully by January, leading to an election with some constitution that's acceptable to the three factions. And I think in addition, there's no question in my mind that there are now a significant number of Iraqi security forces in the field who are armed and who believe they've been given a chance to create a new Iraq. So if all this transpires, then by January through next summer, we ought to see the energy start to drain out of this insurgency.
General, with respect, we seem to have heard this before. You know, it's going to be a tough next couple of months, but then we'll turn a corner.
Yeah. Well, I think you're quite correct. I think the rhetoric out of the Pentagon, Secretary Rumsfeld, and some of the senior civilian leadership has been clearly one of denial to the sort of the extent and complexity of the difficulties we face. And then I think they have spun this thing in a way more than optimistic fashion. But what you're hearing from me is a person who has been a critic of the way Rumsfeld and his team have handled the war, but who also, I might add, thought this was the right war in the right place at the right time from the beginning. I think now the momentum is building, and that this brilliant ambassador, John Negroponte, and General John Abizade, our CENTCOM commander, got a strategy on track, which appears to me to be biting in. Look, the bottom line is, we're not going to win the war in Iraq. The question is, can we facilitate standing up an Iraqi political system and security force that can create a new nation? That's really what's at stake.
In the meantime, you extravagantly praise American forces in Iraq as a superb quality military leadership, solid discipline, high morale, enormous individual and unit courage. At the same time, you say that there's an expected meltdown of the Army National Guard and Army Reserve.
Yeah. Well, it's not very contradictory. I think the combat troops in the field are may well be the best in the nation's history. They're brilliantly led. The sergeants, the captains, the battalion commanders, they've got good equipment. They've got good doctrine. They're actually created a situation in Iraq now where the insurgents largely are incapable of massing in more than squad-sized units. In that environment, what we are hoping to do is see the beginning of a political process of integration, the beginning of economic reconstruction, the beginning of forming a law-abiding state. I think the problem is right now, though, there's 290 million of us Americans, a very small military force. You know, it's large in numbers, and we keep talking about, you know, biggest budget in the world on defense. But essentially, it's the tiniest number of people we've had in uniform as a percentage of the nation's manpower in any war we fought, and a very small percentage of the nation's GNP. And I think they're being overused. Most of the Army guys are on their third combat tour, year combat tour, and some of the Marines are now actually starting their fifth 7-month combat tour. We're running these people ragged. The word is getting out. Half that force in the field in Iraq right now is reserve component. I mean, thank God for the National Guard and the reserves. They came forward. But I think we're starting to run out of steam on this thing. The force is too small to sustain this type of foreign policy.
And the other another point you make is that obviously public support in this country is critical. Public support is dwindling.
Yeah, I think so. You know, if you look back on Vietnam, and Iraq clearly is nothing like Vietnam in so many ways, but what is common is at the end of the day, it wasn't the bloodshed that caused us to not achieve our purpose in Vietnam. It was the growing belief on the part of the American people that the political leadership didn't know what they were doing. And I think the same thing has begun to take place here. I mean, when Secretary Rumsfeld, for a better part of a year, denied there was an insurgency. He was talking about, well, you know, stuff happens, and this is like D.C.'s crime rate. And it was a fundamental and almost unbelievable denial of the evidence in front of their eyes. We got in there with too little combat power. This thing got away from us, and now we're trying to bring it together. And I actually believe we have a pretty good chance of pulling this off. And at least seeing the thing look much different next summer.
General McCaffrey, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Neil.
General Barry McCaffrey joined us by phone from his offices in Arlington, Virginia. For an update on one aspect of the security equation, the Iraqi police, we turn now to Colonel Richard Swengros. He's stationed in Baghdad in command of the 42nd Military Police Brigade. He's the leader of the Police Partnership Program, and he joins us now by phone from Baghdad. Appreciate your staying up this evening to speak with us.
Thank you. No problem at all.
Obviously, there have been a spate of attacks against Iraqi police forces, terrible ones today and yesterday. How do they affect the training program?
The training program is assessed and evaluated on a routine basis. And what we look at is exactly what the police need to accomplish their mission. And as the attacks increased on the police, we've already made several adjustments to their training program in the academy, as well as follow-up training that they get once they graduate from the academy. Just recently, we moved the academy class length from 8 weeks to 10 weeks, and those new 2 weeks are strictly to gain or help the Iraqis gain confidence in their weapon systems, in tactics and procedures to ensure their survival out there on the streets as they try and conduct their law enforcement business in the middle of terrorist activity in the area.
But they're frequently the target of terrorist activity in the area. How can police police if they're barricaded up in their police stations?
Well, they were barricaded up in their police stations probably 8 to 10 months ago. Since December, we have not lost a police station here in Baghdad at all. The Iraqi police do provide security on their police stations. That is a obviously a smart thing to do. But what they've been able to do is now move out into the streets, into patrol vehicles, 4 to to eight people per patrol set, and they move about the city patrolling and reducing crime. A little bit different in terms of reducing crime. We're not talking about the terrorist activity at that point. They are making a difference as they reduce what we would consider more normal city crime.
Mm-hmm. There's a report in Time magazine this week that quotes an upcoming report from State Department and Pentagon that is expected to say, quote, too many recruits, we're talking about Iraqi police recruits, too many recruits are marginally literate. Some show up for training with criminal records or physical handicaps. Some recruits are allegedly insurgents. Is that fair to say?
I think that is an overarching snapshot of what has happened. Is it the norm to have illiterate? The answer is no. There actually is a literacy test that is given, and they do have to pass the literacy test before they can enter the academy. That process is going well. It does channel some recruits that need additional work, and there's a program set up to actually give them more reading skills and writing skills so they can pass the literacy test and enter into the academy. And this is something that is not driven by any outside community. This is something that the Iraqi police chiefs sorely want. They want a very professional force. As I talk to them continuously the past 8 months, and here through the elections, the Iraqi police have gone from a force that was looked down upon, paid very little, to a force that now stands up, and in the words of the Iraqi police chiefs, the first time in 35-year career they have known that the people are actually looking up to the police. That is not something that we saw 8 months ago, but it is something we've seen the last 6 months, and it continues to grow.
Colonel Swengros, stay with us, if you will. We have to take a short break.
Okay.
We'll also take your calls after we come back if you have questions about the security situation in Iraq. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We'll also focus when we return on more situations of daily life in the economy in the country, 800-989-8255, or email us, TOTN@NPR.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Even as Sunnis rejoin negotiations over Iraq's constitution today, suicide bombers rocked the capital, killing at least 15 people. This hour, we're looking at political and military situation in Iraq, as well as how normal Iraqis have weathered the ongoing insurgency and chaos. We want to hear your questions. What do you want to know about daily life in Iraq, about the process of rebuilding and economic development? 800-989-8255. Email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Right now, we're talking with Colonel Richard Swengros. He's the commander of the 42nd Military Police Brigade and leader of the Police Partnership Program with Iraqi police. He's with us on the phone from Baghdad. And Colonel, one part of the Time magazine report that we didn't get to just before the break was reports that the Iraqi police have been infiltrated by insurgents.
The Iraqi police are like any organization out there. You will find some folks that I'm not sure are really infiltrated by the insurgents, but are threatened, or their families are threatened with their lives, and they've seen both their fellow police and their fellow police families gunned down. And I think you see more of that than you see of somebody deliberately planning and being part of an insurgent group. Although I will say that obviously it's certainly possible that there are some out there, but I think the problem is more being threatened and having in their minds no recourse but to acquiesce to whatever demand is occurring at that particular time.
So providing information to the insurgents whether they are insurgents or not.
Well, I think what we're seeing here as I investigate charges of corruption, it's more of you arrested my friend, brother, no matter what it is, you either release him now or we're going to blow up the police station or kill your families. Those are the type of threats, and so the police are left with trying to figure out how to deal with that. Luckily, there's not much of that going on because we've put a stop to that with some very deliberate and hard-pressed campaigns, information campaigns with the Iraqi police, letting them know there's other options out there. And We've had actually some number of successes this past few weeks as we've been able to deal with that particular problem and alleviate some of the pressures from the local police stations.
Is there anything you could tell us about those successes in particular?
Well, mainly it involves if somebody is arrested and they get the police station gets a threatening call, we will stand by the police during periods of threatened attack. We will look to help the Iraqi police move the individual to another police station and continue it within the Iraqi police jurisdiction and then just keep that pressure off the police station. That has seemed to work, but other details I won't be able to mention right now.
Mm-hmm. Before we let you go, you were stationed in Kosovo before this. Any comparison, anything you learned there that's applicable in Iraq?
Yes, sir. Actually, there is. When I was in Kosovo and then here in Iraq, I learned real quick that you can't just grow a police station from the streets and you can't just grow it from the top. You have to have a partnership or an ability to influence the police at the top levels of the police organization straight down to the station levels. And that's what we've done here the past 6.5 months with this police partnership program. It involves, in Baghdad, myself, my brigade staff working with the chief of police of Baghdad, and my staff working with his staff, and then my subordinate military police elements working with the subordinate Iraqi police elements down to the individual station commander working with a platoon leader. And what that has done is it allows us to work both the military and Iraqi police systems of support and training so that we can address issues all the way up and down the chain, allow them to gain confidence, and this confidence has really just taken off full speed here in the last couple of months.
Are you confident, Colonel? Is this going to work?
I think it is. In fact, I am much more confident than I was 6 months ago, to be frank with you. The Iraqi police, to stand up and face the dangers they have every day, and then continue to work and continue to learn. As I said earlier, back in November, they were running from the terrorists. As late as 30 days ago, there was a relatively major attack on a police station, and with about 15 Iraqi police and a couple of machine guns, they thwarted the attack until the arrival of additional Iraqi police forces to thwart the terrorists, and then they chased after the terrorists, capturing and killing them. That would not have happened many months ago, but it's happening now, and it's happening more frequently, not only in Baghdad, but throughout the country. As we give them more training, they have more equipment, they have more confidence, and the pride that I talked about before is stepping forward. The public is urging them on, and there is no shortage of police volunteers standing at the gates or Army volunteers standing at the gates waiting to sign up and join the forces to try and help stabilize and secure their home country.
There's a caller on the line. Would you have a moment to take a question from a caller?
I can do that.
Sure. All right. This is Casey, and Casey's calling us from Washington, D.C.
Yes, sir. Well, good afternoon, Neil. I work in Washington, D.C., and we've been hearing a lot of complaints from our citizens in Baghdad and here in the U.S., saying that the part of the Iraqi, new Iraqi forces, they are coming from different militia groups like Badr Brigade and others, and they're joining the police force, and then after graduating, they are settling the scores with the previous regime members and some collaborators of the previous regime members. Mm-hmm. And we've been hearing a lot of things out, and really a lot of complaint, and some of the U.S. Citizen Iraqi origin, they keep sending some letters and complaints to the congressmen and senators and so forth. What do you say about that, sir?
Just to say the Badr Brigade is a Shia militia. Go ahead, Colonel.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think you'll have all sorts of reports back and forth. There was a lot of finger-pointing back and forth about who's doing what to whom. Some of this has nothing to do with terrorist groups, has nothing to do with one former organization or another. What we have done here is we have taken the Iraqi people for what they are and their pride. We've put them into organizations, and we are continually to try and help them work through their situations. Does Does this exist? Probably. Is it widespread? I do not think so. We are continually working to curb any type of improper behavior. We have partnerships with the Iraqi special police forces, the commandos, with the Iraqi army, with the Iraqi police, and we are finding more and more, again, that there are leaders and there are Iraqis out there that are standing up and saying, we're tired of this. We're not putting it up with it anymore. So, yes, it still does exist. There's still some problems out there. But I think in terms of where the Iraqi people want to go, we're turning the corner.
Casey, thanks very much for the call.
There was a report also from Baghdad, from the people over there, saying that there's some part of the Iranian intel, they infiltrated the Ministry of Interior.
I did not catch that question.
He said it was a report of Iranian intelligence infiltrating the Ministry of the Interior.
Yeah, well, I'm working the police side of that, so I really do not have any first-hand information on that. I'd just be speculating.
All right, Casey. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Colonel Swengross, we appreciate your time this evening. We know it's late there.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Colonel Richard Swengross, commander of the 42nd Military Police Brigade, joined us by phone from his office in Baghdad. Iraqi security, or the lack of it, continues to occupy a prime spot in news coverage. In less dramatic fashion, Iraqis are also struggling to improve their daily lives and create an economy. To talk about that process, joining us now is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. He's with us now by phone from their studios here in Washington, D.C. Michael, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. Nice to be with you.
The economy in Iraq, if reports are to be believed, appears to be improving slightly. Is this a trend that can be expected to continue?
Well, I think that's right. That's the right way to characterize it. And yes, I would say the trend, which has been in that very gentle upward direction for a while, will probably continue. Unfortunately, that may not be fast enough to really give us the kind of momentum we need to defeat the insurgency, because there is still 30-some percent of all Iraqis looking for work who can't find it. And that statistic, as much as any other, may tell you why there are still a lot of potential recruits for the insurgency. But yes, the overall trend, I think, is in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. How available are, as you say, obviously security plays a tremendous role. People aren't going to start new enterprises if they fear they're going to be blown up.
That's right. And of course, Iraq also doesn't have a real strong tradition of entrepreneurship, or perhaps I should say more accurately, there's plenty of tradition of the street bazaar, but not a lot of starting businesses that produce things. Most of industry of any kind was in the hands of the state in the Saddam era. We think of the Saddam era as being a period of kleptocracy and, you know, a brutal tyranny, but it was also socialism, essentially. And the Iraqi economy was so centrally run that a lot of the spirit of capitalism that you want to count on at this point isn't quite there, except at this very low level of street activity and street bazaars and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What about basic services, fundamental things, electricity, water, diesel and gasoline?
On the latter couple of points, I think the fuel availability is getting better. Now, there's still these stories every so often about lines at gas stations that stretch a mile around several city blocks and so forth. And that's true, but it's also a function of how many more cars are on the roads these days and the fact that overall there are more wealthy people in Iraq now than there were 3 years ago. So that part of the equation, I think, is generally positive. On the other hand, some other kinds of infrastructure, for example, electricity availability, has just finally reached the levels that it was at during the Saddam Hussein era, and that's after demand has grown enormously in the last 2 years. Iraqis really expect a lot more electricity, and they've been getting less. Finally, they're getting about the same amount that Saddam was delivering in terms of average kilowatt hours. The power is still off, however, at least half the time in major cities, and sabotage is a huge issue. And it's simply not a dependable environment on which you can, you know, turn on your electricity, your air conditioner, what have you, and expect to have power. So there's a long way still to go. Again, a little bit of progress in the last 2 or 3 months, but not nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Ben. Ben's calling from Salem, Oregon.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. My original question was going to be about Sharia law and the, you know, it was for the last person, but actually this leads to an interesting follow-up question. Has the government looked into employing folks who were involved in some of the reconstruction in Eastern Europe? seeing as you've got some of the same socialist lack of capitalist drive, has any of the rebuilding been focused in similar directions?
That's a great question, Ben. I don't know if I can do it much justice. And without commenting on the Eastern Europe experience in any detail, since I'm not an expert there, I would say that, you know, what you've really got in Iraq, one thing we've noticed throughout this period is that our military has done a much better job maintaining continuity of people who developed expertise in the 1990s in Europe, although, as you know, in that case, it was Bosnia and Kosovo, not the Czech Republic and Poland. But nonetheless, there was a fair amount of institutional expertise that was developed to the point where someone like Lieutenant General Dave Petraeus, who's now training the Iraqi security forces, was instrumental in the Balkan Wars. And that kind of institutional memory has not been as created, not as well created on the reconstruction, stabilization, and State Department side as it has been on the military side. So the short answer to your question, I'm rather confident in saying, is no, we have not really tapped into whatever expertise might have been there like we have on the military side.
Too bad.
Thanks for the call, Ben.
Thank you.
And finally, Michael, what's it going to take to reach a tipping point, do you think, in terms of economic takeoff, if you will?
Well, Neil, it's so tough because, as you mentioned, the security environment impedes us from doing anything very constructive. I tend to think, therefore, the best single thing you can do at this moment, it's not really going to build a strong Iraqi economy in and of itself, but it will get money into the pockets of Iraqis, is a jobs program, essentially a 1930s-style, Great Depression-style jobs program, where unemployment itself is seen as a short-term scourge. Independent of the quality of the economy. And so you pay people a modest amount of money to do things that may have only limited long-term economic significance or utility in a healthy future Iraqi economy. But at least in the short term, you don't give people the temptation to take $50 to fire an RPG at an American convoy because they have another job that can give them that same $50 over the course of a week's work or what have you. That's the single best thing I believe we can do. We've done some of that through these Commander's Emergency Response Program funds, which have been really in the just tens and hundreds of millions of dollars total. But they've allowed people to do a lot of quick work to get money into the pockets of nearby citizens, to clean up cities after the war, after the invasion. A lot of that was done by General Petraeus up north when he was in Mosul, by others, General Odierno in Tikrit. It seems to have started well, but it was not the thrust of our economic reconstruction activity. And I think I would put more effort and more money there.
Michael O'Hanlon, the Brookings Institution, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Shala Wali, Iraq Country Director for the international nonprofit Counterpart International. She's with us now by phone from Amman, Jordan. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us.
It's our pleasure.
You've traveled to different locations in Iraq over the past year. How are things going for Iraqis? We hear so much about Baghdad and the immediate environs. What about the rest of the country? How are things going?
Well, the things in general, it's different directions because in terms of economy, it's going down and very deteriorating direction in terms of local markets. In terms of other things, in terms of giving trainings to the Iraqi people, to giving them the powerful, to have the participatory in there and creating the rate of their involvement in the process, it's going upwards. In terms of the security, it's going deteriorating daily nowadays, especially that we're expecting to have the final draft of our constitution by mid of August. So there are different categorization and different direction according to each sector in Iraq.
Has employment changed? Are people taking up even black market professions to get by?
Yeah, of course. The black market is spreading out everywhere nowadays in Iraq, and they are getting money out of it. And the employment rate, if you consider it as disguised in employment, it's everywhere in Iraq because, you know, there are different private sectors and tradesmen and job opportunities that it's really not contributing to the reforming of economy. It's just giving the daily standard living to the Iraqi people.
And what is most difficult? Is it still security, obviously, for most people? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I was asking, what's most difficult for most people? We just have a few seconds left in this segment, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay. The most difficult thing, yes, first priority is in terms of security. And the other thing is that there are this security contributes in other factors, like they are so hesitant to have investment in terms of big investment inside, for example, Baghdad or any other cities in Iraq.
Well, I'm afraid the phone line has gone down. We thank Shala Wali, the Iraq Country Director for the International Development Group, Counterpart International. She was kind enough to join us this evening from Amman, Jordan. When we come back from a break, we'll talk with the Defense Department spokesman and then with Stephen Bochco about over there. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're looking at the rest of the picture in Iraq. If you have questions about the security situation in Iraq, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. The Defense Department recently released its most comprehensive report to date on Iraq. The Security and Stability in Iraq report states that the insurgency and the weak economy will not derail Iraqi security forces from eventually taking over from coalition soldiers. From the Pentagon, Lawrence Derrida, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, joins us now to talk about this report. It's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and thanks for doing this show.
According to the report, what is the economic and security situation in Iraq? We're hearing reports that security continues to deteriorate.
Well, it's uneven. It depends on where you are in the country. In some parts of the country, most of the attacks are kind of clustered in four provinces that are well known to be areas of activity for the insurgents. That's out of 18 provinces. The other 14 provinces are, for the most part, fairly stable. There are episodic attacks, but there tends to be a fairly localized area of the country where the attacks are occurring. Now, granted, they're powerful attacks, and they're becoming, in some cases, more powerful in the sense that these car bombs are becoming more sophisticated. But also, the insurgents seem to be going for softer targets. Their attacks on infrastructure, for example, are reduced over the past period of time. But attacks on civilians queuing up at markets, et cetera, are going up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an uneven situation, much like a lot of the conditions in the country.
Yet the pace of attacks, the rate of attacks, seems to be either steady or increasing. And as you say, lethality is terrible.
Yeah, if you look at, for example, on infrastructure, on the oil, on the pipelines, on the electrical systems, it's at a level that's lower than it was prior to the elections, prior to the transfer sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as you correctly point out, it is easy to attack civilians, and that's what is happening, and that is an element of the terror in this campaign. There's no question about it. But it's also mixed. If you look at the participation in the electoral process in the Iraqis' own assessment of their prospects for the future, we're still having people recruited for police, recruited for the security forces, coming out to participate in the constitutional drafting. So, like everything else in Iraq, it's uneven, but the trend line is one toward the electoral timeline that's been established by the Iraqi administrative law.
One reason there may be no shortage of recruits for Iraqi police and military units, that part seems to be true, is that there's little to do in the rest of the economy. If it's improving very slowly.
Yeah, it is. There's some good indications and some less good. For example, the currency has remained remarkably stable in the last year, which tends to be a sign of confidence in the economy. There's new business starts are up greater than 50%. This is in the report.
Mm-hmm.
Internet access has grown dramatically. The amount of cell phones has probably quadrupled to more than about 2.5 million cell phone users from something on the order of 500,000 last year at this time. So there are areas of undeniable progress and other areas where obviously unemployment remains too high, and that's one of the particular focuses of the coalition is to get some of these folks back to work.
I'm sure you saw the New York Times report that quoted a senior Army intelligence officer that was published yesterday, who basically said, even though we're arresting and killing a lot of insurgents, there seems to be no shortage of replacements. There always seems to be a new insurgent ready to step up and take somebody's place.
Yeah, and that's why ultimately this is going to be something that the Iraqis themselves are going to have to defeat, because once it becomes, I would say from a certain perspective, in fact, from the insurgents' perspective, one would have to wonder, what are their measures of success? We've laid out some of ours in this document, but if the insurgents had hoped to stop the transfer of sovereignty, that didn't happen. If they had hoped to stop the transfer or the elections in January, that didn't happen. If they had hoped to stop the development of the Constitution, that's not going to happen. So notwithstanding their own ability to cause a great deal of mayhem through these indiscriminate killings, if you're looking at their metrics, I mean, we've laid out some of ours, but if you look at theirs, they're not, they are able to kill a lot of innocent people. That's a fairly easy metric to match, and they're doing that through a very indiscriminate way. But in terms of a strategic ability to derail the progress in that country, they haven't, at least thus far, been able to do that.
The security situation in Iraq prevents journalists from reporting on activities much outside of Baghdad. In testimony prepared for the Armed Forces Committee last week, General Barry McCaffrey, whom we spoke with earlier in this program, alleged that U.S. Armed Forces have consistently aggravated this situation by not providing enough material support to reporters, and that senior officers avoid interviews with reporters not considered friendly to the military.
I don't have any evidence of that. I'll tell you, in fact, the opposite is true. If reporters want to report anything going on in Iraq outside of Baghdad, it's a very easy thing to do because the rest of the country is fairly easy to move around in. They are in Baghdad because that's the capital. That's the place where it's most convenient to report on national politics, but it's also the place where it's easiest to talk about the car bombs because that's where they're happening. But if they want to talk about economic progress, it would be interesting to go down to Basra, for example, where the nightlife is booming, where there's an awful lot of economic activity going on, particularly when you consider how poor that city is and how oppressed it was during the Saddam Hussein period. We have tried very hard to facilitate and have, I think, done so with some success getting reporters around the country. We've offered we routinely offer rides to people that want to get to another part of the country to go see what else is going on besides standing in one spot in Baghdad reporting on the latest car bomb. There's no question it's an aspect of the story to talk about the violence, but it's equally an aspect of the story to talk about the progress. And there's been insufficient discussion about that because there's been insufficient interest in reporters leaving Baghdad. And we've tried very aggressively to facilitate their departure from Baghdad so they can go look at other things.
Lawrence DeRita, thanks very much for taking the time for us today.
Thanks very much for having us.
Lawrence DeRita is Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs and joined us from the Pentagon.